This is a podcast for Monday, November 14th, 2011, Ethics.
Okay, if you go to atlassociety.org and click on Interactive Webinars, 5 p.m. there's going to be something on the virtue of independence. And it's about the question of how do we live as independent beings in an interdependent or interconnected world. And so that'll be at 5 o'clock. I was saying, if you want to do the extra credit assignment, you can write your 1,000 words on that. Just make sure that 333 of those words are your thoughts, your opinions, your logical analysis of what's said in the webinar, and not just, I don't want the whole thing to be a summarization of what you saw. I want some critical analysis. And there was other webinars there. So what I was saying was, you could do one on the virtues. I guess you could do one on any of them. They have a couple on the Atlas Shrugged movie. A lot of these are on the virtues. So as we'll see today, there's a lot of overlap between Ayn Rand and Aristotle. She saw Aristotle as the greatest of philosophers, and her view, even though it's an egoist view, it focuses on these virtues. And so so there's a whole series on the objectivist virtues on the Atlas Society website. So if you want to listen to any one of those and then do your extra credit essay on that, that would be fine. Okay, let's see other things. Coming this Thursday, Ellis Goldberg will be here talking about the democracy movement in Egypt. So if you're interested in that, there will be a talk open to the public over in the CML, Center for Media and Learning, Building 19. Probably got another name that I don't know about. In the lobby there, it's 5:30. And there's also going to be a talk someplace. There's going to be a talk on campus at 1 o'clock. I'll post that to the forums if I haven't already. But the 5:30 one is over in that big meeting room they have over in Building 19, where they have this sort of the staircase that comes down in a big lobby. And the it's the biggest room on campus there. So 102, 104, something like that. They sort of take all these rooms and make them into one big room. So that'll be at 5:30 on Thursday. I think that's all I have in the way of announcements. Any questions about the extra credit essay or anything else? Yes, sir.
About, well, if you said anything else, I was listening to a podcast on last week's lecture, last Wednesday.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a question for you. Do you want me to wait on that? Or?
Sure, no, go ahead.
Okay. Kant was talking about positive responsibility and negative responsibility. And so, he had his two tests, or his two criteria to make an assessment of what one should do. You asked for an example of what might be an example of person who says, I'll borrow money, but I'll pay that after a while. We're talking on that. And my question is, what might Kant say about something that's institutionalized? When you're talking before class, and if the Congress, for example, repeatedly says, pass this spending bill and we will make cuts to pay for it. And it's done over and over and over again. The bills get passed, the cuts never are made.
Okay.
What happens, what would Kant say when it becomes institutionalized? Do you have to stay and work within the parameters of the system, like elections, recalls, that sort of thing?
Right.
Or would he favor, like, the Occupy folks and say, no, to hell with the system, we'll just go outside of it? Where might he fall on that issue? What might he talk about?
Anybody have any thoughts on that? I got a couple, but I want to see if anyone else thinks. What would Kant think about, like, politics in general, I suppose?
Yes, that's what I'm
hearing. But what would you think about cases where, and I guess you're thinking about cases of, like, institutionalized corruption where a promise doesn't mean anything. A politician will make a promise and then break it and then does it over and over again. So you just sort of expect, yeah, this guy's lying and that guy's lying too. Which guy is the least incompetent? And you're voting for Tweedledum over Tweedledumber.
I think Kant doesn't like those lesser of evils choices. Like, you think about, here's a great case of utilitarianism versus deontology. So suppose you have two candidates that are really close, and one of them is better than the other one, but there's a third candidate who you really like and is really in line with your principles. Then the question is, do you vote for the lesser of evils, or do you vote for the guy that has no chance of winning? And Kant would say, you have to vote your principles, you have to vote your conscience, as they say. And so, like, if you're a Ron Paul guy, even though he's got 9%, you know, you vote for him, because, why? Because you can't base your decisions on the consequences. It has to be based on principles, and if he has the best principles, then you can't say, well, you know, here's a guy who's less corrupt than the other guy, and I'm going to vote for him to keep the more corrupt guy out. Yeah.
The problem with that, and this is the flaw I see with Kant, with that, keeping with your example, if the proper thing to do is to change the system that's at hand, this candidate has ideas that we're doing, so your goal is to put his views into practice,
mm-hmm.
because they're more correct. If you know that wasting your vote on this because he will not win, and therefore won't have influence, do you choose, of the options that could possibly win, the one that will take a step towards this end, if you can't have an incrementalism?
Yeah.
So does Kant value incrementalism in decision making, or is it all or nothing all the time?
I think for Kant, thinking in terms of goals isn't really moral thinking.
Okay, well, I was defining the goal as doing the moral thing. So that's my layer on top of it.
It's kind of weird because Kant thinks that you can sort of think about these abstract principles and apply them to particular cases without really thinking about what it is you're trying to accomplish. You're just trying to follow a rule. You're not trying to achieve a goal, because that's engaged in this means ends reasoning, which is all hypothetical imperatives, not these categorical imperatives. I mean, a utilitarian could go either way, right? A utilitarian might say, well, vote for the lesser of evils. And I guess that would, if I put this on a test, like, what would a utilitarian say? You know, A, vote your conscience, you know, B, vote for the lesser of evils. It would obviously be B. But then you can kind of take a utilitarian view and say, well, long term, maybe if you vote for this third party candidate, maybe over time the third party sort of catches on steam, or the anti-establishment movement sort of just catches on. I mean, one of the reasons why things got shook up in with the 94 election, which, you know, brought Newt Gingrich in, who's, you know, surging the polls now in the presidential race, is because of Perot in 92, where you had a kind of shake up of the establishment. And so people think, well, if I vote for a third party, maybe long term, you can get something done. But then, Kant wouldn't like that, though, because it's all, you're thinking pragmatically. Kant really hated pragmatists. He would say that you have to vote on principle, because as soon as you start thinking, well, okay, that's kind of like the lofty, the moral thing to do, but if I really want to do some good in the world, I gotta compromise a little bit, right? I gotta, I think it would be an example. I'm trying to think of a good example of where you might sort of, can anybody think of a good example where you might sort of compromise a little bit in order to, yeah?
If I'm on a hike and I want to get up to the top of Mary's Peak, I can go on a straight line, which is the shortest distance. Or I can take the trail, which is going to wind all the way around here, and we'll get me there.
Uh-huh.
Taking the most direct route, the following moral principle, never deviating from it, is good in theory, but it doesn't always get you to your goal.
An example of what you're talking about, I heard Newt Gingrich and, what's the southern gentleman, Is that his
Rick
name?
Perry?
Perry from Texas?
No, he was the Democratic Party. James Carville. We're in a room together talking to a group of university students, and they said that exact same thing that you just said, compromise. You said we would never get anything done if we didn't come to be compromised on bills and things like that.
Now,
you have to do it.
Yeah, sometimes they'll talk about you can compromise on particular pieces of legislation versus on principles. And sometimes people make this distinction. They'll say, well, I didn't compromise my principles. We sort of traded horses in this particular case. One good example might be where there's this saying, don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. And the idea is that if you have to have something absolutely perfect, there's people that, like, there's libertarians that won't vote for Ron Paul because he's not libertarian enough. They're going to vote for the Libertarian Party, which has never garnered more than 1%, right? And so, whereas you get people who are more pragmatic, they say, well, I don't like Ron Paul on immigration and abortion, but the rest of it is pretty good, and so if I agree with him 80%. It makes sense to vote for him in the Republican primary because Libertarian candidate has no chance of winning. So you get people sort of have degrees of pragmatism. Harry Brown, one of the more libertarian examples, that Harry Brown ran for president as on the Libertarian ticket in a bunch of times, 90, 92, 96, I think 2000 might have been the last one. And he refused to take federal matching funds. Did I bring this up last time? So if you're running and you get, like, if you're on the ballot in all 50 states, the federal government, for every dollar you raise, will kick in a dollar. So it's a pretty good deal. If you get too much money coming in from, there's certain requirements you have to meet. Sometimes people have so much money, they turn down the federal matching funds because they can make more not having to be bound by the rules. But anyway, you have a third-party candidate, no money in his war chest. And he refused to take the federal matching funds on principle that the government shouldn't fund elections. Well, what does that do for him? You know, when you're thinking about contributing to this guy, it's like he's not even taking the government money, and he's not taking the government money because he thinks it's wrong. But if you took the government money, you'd have a greater chance of, as you said, overturning the system. But the question is, like, then where do you draw the line? I think for Kant, anytime you make a little compromise, you're down that slippery slope to justifying something which is entirely wrong. One of the examples, like on the last exam, was it on the last exam or is it? I guess it was this one. I'm trying to remember if it was this one in process or whether it was the first one. Well, this is a good example for Kant. So what would Kant say, like, if you could... what do utilitarians say? If you could... suppose cheating on a test would, through a series of effects, lead to $500,000 being given to Lane Community College. Should you do it?
Utilitarian would say yes.
Utilitarian would probably say yes. You know, assuming the negative consequences didn't outweigh the good you would do. But what would Kant say?
No,
because it would lead to... He would say, not because it might lead to bad consequences, because it's wrong in and of itself, because cheating is wrong, period. I guess that would be a contradiction of concept, because in a world of cheaters, there would be no such thing as academic honesty, and there would be no such thing, I suppose, as objective achievement. So that's kind of like the two... And so Kant thinks that if you start making those concessions, you're going to sort of go down the primrose path to saying, well, stealing is wrong in general, but, you know, I really need the money, and that rich SOB really doesn't need it as much as I do, and, you know, he can just go out and buy another wedding ring, and he'll go get over being held up at gunpoint eventually. He's got a lot of money for therapy. And you just sort of, you know, just start justifying and rationalizing it once you start doing that. So that's why he sort of has this hardline thing where he even says, if a murderer comes to your door and asks you, like, if your family's home,
You have to say yes. You can't say, oh, they're down at the police station. Or you can't say, they're not home or something. You have to say something like, you know, yes, and I'll defend them to my death or something. But you can't even lie to a person that wants to kill your family, according to Kant, which is a kind of a hardline position. And one, I think, of the criticisms of Kant, that he's just kind of too radical.
Did he actually live by this?
It's
a philosophy.
It's hard to say. I mean, he's a college professor, so he's kind of insulated from the real world. You know, doesn't have these tough decisions to make. Kind of a cushy existence, so it's hard to say. But I mean, he did live a very regimented life. He like took a walk at the same time every day, and you know, followed the same path, and spent most of his time alone just study writing when he wasn't teaching. So. Yeah, very disciplined, very sort of characteristically German, I guess. It's kind of interesting if you think about, I'm not really just psychologizing about philosophers, but a lot of the attitudes of Kant are sort of quintessentially part of German culture, the focus on duty, this kind of austerity, the kind of a stoic approach to life, the idea that happiness is suspect, are all sort of part and parcel of Germanic culture. I guess it goes back to the sort of German barbarians and the Teutonic culture. It's up here.
Okay, thank you.
Sure. I just got a couple of criticisms of Kant, and the PowerPoint that I'm putting up here, I've got to add a couple more slides, so. I'm not sure why that's not showing up there. We'll see what happens. So we're going to get on and move on to Aristotle today. But one of the criticisms of Kant's view is that it's just sort of too extreme. And sometimes you might say that maybe you have multiple values that you're trying to decide between, and Kant really doesn't give you any guidance when you have, say, a conflict between two duties. So one thing you might say is that when a murderer comes to your door and wants to kill your family, you have a duty to tell the truth, but you also have a duty to protect your family. And so you might revise Kant's view and say, well, when you have two duties, maybe there's the duty to protect your family trumps your duty to tell the truth. And maybe you have less of a duty to tell the truth to a murderer. Maybe he doesn't deserve the truth. So in that way, you might kind of have a hierarchy of duties. And that might give a way out for Kant, whereas his view doesn't seem so extreme. So you could say, okay, my duty to protect the lives of my family trumped my duty to tell the truth, so therefore it's okay to lie to this person that doesn't deserve the truth in this particular case. I don't think Kant would like it, but it softens his view and makes it seem a little more rational. Probably, but no, you're back in the okay. You're back in the fourth row. You're probably fine. I covered my cough. Yeah, generally I've actually taken a photo class and I had to be there, so otherwise I would have called in sick. I figured since I'm up here, it is the eighth week. I don't want to fall behind.
That's utilitarian choice.
Yeah, so it's the utilitarian. Actually, it's kind of an egoist choice, I think. It's like my philosophy class, yeah. But I'm going to get those points on my photo assignment.
I suppose it's not very entertaining to give a lecture to yourself and then put it online.
Here we go. So one criticism doesn't tell you what to do, and two duties conflict. So, and you have things like this all the time where you have, you know, some duty of loyalty or a promise that you made, maybe in haste, and then you might have a higher obligation. You make these judgments all the time, right? You break a promise. Suppose you have two conflicting promises and you got to break one of them. Well, how do you decide which one you're going to break? Think about it. Anybody have a case where you made two, where you're bound by two promises and you couldn't keep them both? Because sometimes stuff happens, right? Well, think about like the you have maybe a duty to obey traffic laws, but also you have a duty to, you know, get your wife to the hospital so she can deliver a baby. So there's two duties, and most people would say your duty to obey traffic laws, you know, is abrogated or not as important. Unless you're, you know, some obsessive rule-following police officer that says the law is the law. I'm trying to think of some other case where you have two, or you would make a promise. You have two promises and you can't keep them both. I always wonder what that sound is. That's a jet. So anyway, sometimes you end up with real life happens and you have two promises. You can't keep both the promises, and so you decide which is more important. Well, here's a good example. So this webinar. So I'm the faculty advisor for yet another club, the Art and Story Alliance. A bunch of guys that want to make comic books. And but also I want to go to this Atlas Society webinar too, which is at exactly the same time. So I have to make a choice. I promised them I'd be there on Monday, but I really want to go to this other thing. So, you know, what do I do? Now imagine like I promised to be both places and just sort of forgotten. Or suppose they moved one of the meetings or something. So this happens all the time, and, you know, especially as an instructor, there's people that there's standing committees where you have an obligation to be at a meeting. At two meetings at once, you have to decide which meeting is more important. And that's, you know, that's day-to-day moral reasoning. Kant doesn't give you any tools for trying to figure those things out. Consequences seem to matter in really extreme cases. So you're dealing with like a whole city being destroyed or millions of people dying. All of a sudden the consequences look like they're really important. And it's kind of a tough bolt to bite to say, no, the consequences never matter. An example, like, you know, if you could tell a little white lie to a terrorist and save a city from going up in a mushroom cloud, would Kant say, oh, no, it would be wrong for you to tell the terrorist, you know, a lie? And that's kind of a tough argument to make. And most people, I think, would say, well, the terrorist is like, he's a bad guy, he doesn't deserve to be told the truth. But Kant's way of thinking, once you say that, you'll say, well, the terrorist doesn't deserve not to be tortured either. And so, and, you know, while you're torturing the terrorist, maybe, you know, those filthy hippies that are camped out in the park, maybe you torture some of them too. So, I mean, you sort of, he sees it as a kind of what's the word I'm looking for? Slippery slope to justifying immorality.
So, question?
Yeah.
You had talked about narrowing the imperatives last time.
Mm-hmm.
Can't you narrow it a little bit and say terrorists that are actively trying to harm Kennedy,
tortured.
They don't have the right to not.
Yeah, might.
How far can he be willing to narrow his absolute statement?
I think, I mean, Kant probably wouldn't like it, but you might say, look, there's a certain amount. You can still think about people having rights, but you might say people give up their right under certain circumstances. Maybe you give up your right to live by committing a homicide, say. And so I think Kant favored the death penalty. So, and Kant thinks that it's okay to kill in time of war. And so maybe you could say, well, it's not exactly war, but it's something akin to it or analogous to it. So maybe it is okay to choose from the terrorist. So it's, I mean, it's tough to, and this is one of the problems with Kant's view too, I think, is that it's tough to see how it would be applied to particular cases. And sometimes Kant seems to be a product of his time, where he says it's always wrong to kill yourself, for example. Well, maybe, you know, if you're talking about narrowing the imperative, so you might say, okay, whenever I'm having a bad day, I'll kill myself. Well, that would lead to a world where nobody was around. But what about whenever I have a terminal illness and have nothing but pain and misery for the next 3 to 6 months of my life and I have an incurable form of cancer, I will go out gracefully. I mean, that seems like it would... that would, you know, it wouldn't lead to everybody dying because not everyone has a terminal illness like that. So maybe Kant's view would go along with suicide and some other things, maybe in the prostitution case. It's just that Kant is applying his theory with kind of historical blinders on, being a product of his time. So we might take Kant's view and appropriate it to sort of modern sensibilities and say, okay, Kant saw things this way, but maybe we can kind of look at things a different way, take the theory and apply it to a particular case without these prejudicial views that Kant had, and without trying to let our own prejudices in as well. Another thing is that Kant really doesn't assign any value to moral feelings. Kant says morality is all about being rational and following your duty. And it seems like in you know, normal moral decision making, things like compassion and think of other virtues. Compassion and sympathy, I suppose, are the big ones, but. Maybe, you know, things like dignity and pride and, you know, all sorts of feelings we have associated with morality. And Kant says, like, say, if a person is acting out of compassion, like the philanthropist who acts out of compassion for suffering humanity, Kant will say, well, he's just doing what he wants to do. He enjoys being generous. He doesn't get any credit for that at all. And so the person who is naturally good is seen as, you know, is kind of morally neutral to Kant, which is kind of weird. Because this is totally the opposite of Aristotle, who says that unless you're acting morally out of habit, you really don't deserve any moral credit. That it's all about character and what you do consistently. For Kant, it's about asserting your will and doing the right thing and beating down those pesky desires and feelings and acting, you know, completely rationally. Kant's kind of a pessimist about human nature. He tends to think about desires as being all selfish, and that seems somewhat unrealistic. Because we have desires to help people as well, it seems. And those seem to be morally good things. The way Kant puts it, it's if you enjoy being generous, it's almost, you're sort of lucky. It's kind of like... I don't know, if you're born in pre-revolution Russia and you have some job as a thankless job as a government bureaucrat, and it just turns out that you really love, like, adding up numbers in a ledger all day. That's like your favorite thing to do in the world. Maybe you're obsessive compulsive or something and you love numbers. Well, it's kind of an accident of fate. You're lucky that your life is happy because you get to do what you love to do, even though this job's been assigned to you by the czar. You're just adding up the numbers in the ledger and you're happier than a clam compared to the guy next to you who's just complete drudgery and he hates his job. And for Kant, I think whether you enjoy doing your duty is just a matter of how you were raised and what your disposition is, and it's something you really don't have any control over. And I'm not really sure that's true either. It seems that as you make decisions about how you'll act, that molds your character, and Kant doesn't seem to take this into account. Character really doesn't matter at all for Kant. he almost approaches every decision as sort of a microcosm, where you make that decision on that act and that act alone in isolation to all other acts. And he doesn't think generally about what kind of person you are or what kind of character you have or what kinds of things motivate you, other than, you know, respect for the moral law. Now here's a big one. So Kant, because he thinks the rational is the moral and the moral is the rational, he thinks that all rational people agree on moral principles. And that just seems to be an absurd statement. I suppose you could say, you know, oh, well, the person that doesn't agree with you is the one who's being irrational. people tend to do that. But, I mean, it seems, if morality really is rationality, that we would get more agreement. Now, I suppose on basic things, like sort of the basis of morality, this might make sense, but when you get to controversial issues, it's, you know, because every time I open up my Facebook page, I have these friends who are like Hollywood actors and, you know, college professors, and they're spouting off all this stuff, and I'm like, oh, that's just like that's so wrong. How can this person be my friend? You know, I'm thinking, and I look at it as I'm like revolted by some of the things that people say. It's just wrong on so many levels. But, you know, I don't think that person is like a Looney Tunes, that they're insane, and I don't think that they're driven by malevolent desires. It's just that they have a different view and about morality than I do. I talked about the ways you can cheat with the categorical imperative. This seems like kind of a weak argument. I mean, there's room to cheat with any of these views. But you can say, you know, whenever a buried philosopher whose initials are JB wants to, you know, loot, pillage, and cause general mayhem, he should be celebrated as a national treasure. And because it only applies to one person, you know, it's universalizable. And then I talked about this already, that Kant's conclusions don't always follow his principles. And so maybe this is a criticism for Kant, but not Kant's view. Maybe the theory is sound. It's just that sometimes he doesn't apply it in the right way. So he might have the right theory, but he might apply it. He might misapply it to particular cases based on, you know, his personal views or his cultural background. I think that's it on Kant. Last comments or questions on Kant?
Can you leave that up?
Yeah. You might say torture, you could add that too. Mm-hmm. Good? Kant's conclusions don't necessarily always follow his principles, e.g. suicide, prostitution. Okay, so there's Aristotle. Aristotle defines ethics in terms of the good person as opposed to the right act. So this is different than all the other approaches we've looked at so far, which tried to say, well, what act is the right act? And what are the necessary and sufficient conditions such that that act and only that act will be the right act? And Aristotle's approach is that if you know what a good person is and you know what a good person would be like, then you would know what a good person would do. And so instead of focusing on individual acts, you should focus in on what a good person is and what how a good person would act. And so he defines the good person in terms of a series of characteristics called virtues, which describe how the person acts in particular situations. And so once you have a list of characteristics of the ideal individual, you've defined the ideal individual, and then you can think, well, what sorts of things would this person do? And this actually helps give a kind of a room for judgment for particular cases. So it's not where you have to look at a particular act and try to sort of look at the pros and cons of the utilitarian calculus, or for Kant, you're juggling these abstract principles and trying to see how they apply to the case. For Aristotle, you have some notion in your mind of what a good person is, and you ask yourself, well, what would a good person do in this case? And you try to make yourself into a good person who always does the right thing in the right amount at the right time. Ethics for Aristotle is all about being successful. And a nice thing about Aristotle is there's no dichotomy between having a good life in the kind of pragmatic sense and having a good life in the moral sense. So a good life in the natural sense of having, you know, making money and having a family and having good relationships and feeling good about yourself and being happy. That he sees as being the same kind of good as treating your neighbor right and giving to the poor and having self-respect and having pride in your accomplishments and being honest and so on. So for him, it's all about what are those qualities which allow you to be a good human being, both in the natural sense and moral sense. The things which will help you win friends and influence people, and also be, you know, a good citizen and a good friend and a good father and a good husband. So for Kant, you know, Kant always sees this dichotomy between here's my duty and then here's my good life. And I'm going to sacrifice my good life in order to do my duty. Whereas Aristotle thinks these things tend to go together. So Aristotle's view is based on a concept of human nature. And so Aristotle says, in order to figure out what the good for man is, you need to figure out what the goal of life is. And so he thinks for everything, there is some way of describing what the best is for that thing. So he thinks for living things all have inherent potentialities. And to be successful means to bring out those inherent potentialities into actuality, to actualize your potential. And so what is our potential? Well, he thinks that, you know, the goal in life, whatever, you having a good life, he uses this word eudaimonia. And the best translation of this, again, is success. Some translators call this happiness, but happiness doesn't really capture what Aristotle's getting after here. He's thinking about eudaimonia as sort of what happens when a plant flowers and grows and stretches its limbs and branches up and is sort of prosperous and well-developed and vibrant. And that's sort of this idea of, I think, human flourishing is one of the kind of stilted translations. But that's kind of the word picture he's working at, this idea of human beings flourishing or flowering. And but I think what's the closest English word here, I think, is it's success, having a successful life. Mistranslated, happiness. And so it means, you know, doing what you're meant or designed to do. And Aristotle does think that everything has a purpose and that you have a purpose. And so to have a successful life means doing what you were meant to do or what you were designed to do. Now, he doesn't necessarily think that, you know, God has a plan for your life and that he wants you to be, you know, an auto mechanic or something like that, or a philosopher. Actually, I take that back. Aristotle thinks that the best thing would be if everybody was a philosopher, but it's just not possible. And I suppose, you know, again, looking at how people are products of their time, Aristotle here is mostly talking about men. He thinks, he is just talking about men. He thinks about women and children sort of in the same category, and slaves also as being the category of those who can't have sort of the fully flourishing life. But that for their own potentialities, they can have a good life, just they can't be the best. And we'll talk a little bit more about that later on, his views on women and slaves and children and so on. Sometimes his system's called a teleological system. We talked about that, I think, last time. Teleological means having to do with purpose, function, or goal. So a teleological system is one which is aimed at some result. So Aristotle would say that human life has a goal, and it is the job of virtue to help you reach that goal. So, you know, it's like egoism or utilitarianism. It's a goal-based theory. And so what you want to do is reach that goal of having a fully successful life. So what is success? What is a successful life? I need to pause here for a second. Here we go. So when you think about the notion of purpose or function, and you could ask the question, like, what is a good X, whatever, you know, fill in the blank. What is a good hammer? So in order to figure out what a good hammer is, you have to know what's a hammer for. What do you do with a hammer? Pound nails, right? So a hammer is supposed to pound nails. What's its characteristic activity or function? Pounding, right? And so a good hammer is one which pounds nails better than any other hammer. And then you can think about, okay, well, what is it that makes a hammer differ from, say, a screwdriver or some other tool? So what's a good hammer? Well, a hammer is a tool intended to pound nails. Which are the best hammers? Those that pound nails the best. What sets it apart? Well, you might look at its shape, and you might say it's got like a weighted head, and it's got maybe a strong grip. Maybe that's the same as a screwdriver, but it's got like the weighted head and the flat end that you use to pound the nails would define the hammer and set it apart from the screwdriver. Now, you can use a screwdriver to pound nails. I've done that before, but it's, you know, it's a tough job, and you might break your screwdriver. It's one of those cheap plastic ones. Or hurt your hand. You hurt your hand with a hammer too, but it's less likely. And then the other thing is you want to ask yourself, what is it about this hammer that allows it to perform its function well? So again, one of the reasons why a hammer is better than a screwdriver for driving nails is it's got that weighted metal head. And actually, if you've ever done any construction work, you know, you don't take... First, you hold the hammer near the bottom, and then you, when you're pounding, you're letting the weight of the hammer do the work. You're not whacking it really hard. You're just kind of swinging it lightly. Yeah.
So is he referencing, like, because I actually collect hammers.
Okay.
there's is he referencing like a good hammer for this particular job, or like a good hammer for all jobs? Because sledgehammers, while you can hit a nail with it, mostly used for deconstruction.
Right. So.
Splitting logs.
So this is my example. It's just like a simple everyday example. I suppose if you wanted to follow the analogy, you might say that in order to be a good human being, sometimes you have to act like a sledgehammer, and sometimes you have to act like a little piton type hammer, and it just depends on the job. But this is just like a general picture of a thing with a purpose. And the idea is you figure out, well, what is a good hammer? You have some notions of like a good hammer, like the ones that cost, you know, 15 or 20 bucks or whatever, or maybe more if you're buying a professional tool. But, you know, it's got like the rubber grip. So one of the things, like if you have a cheap hammer and it's like got a handle that's made of like some wood and you're like pounding, all of a sudden you're just kind of sweating, right? And the sweat's trickling down your arm. And all of a sudden you bring your hand down and the hammer goes, whoop, and it goes and hits your buddy in the face. And that's not good, right? So that's a bad design. So most of the better hammers have like a rubber grip. And they have like a weighted head that's balanced, right? So all these things, balance and the grip, are all part of what makes some hammers better than other hammers. And it's why a thing shaped like a screwdriver isn't as good for pounding nails. So if you follow all these lines along and you think about living things or natural things, you can ask like what is the purpose of the eye? So there's, just as there are purposes in, you know, human artifacts and tools, Aristotle thinks there's purpose in nature. So what's the purpose of the eye? The purpose of the eye is to see. That's its function. That's what it does. An eye is better for seeing than, say, for feeling the texture of objects. So suppose you got done with your hammer and you're trying to figure out what sandpaper you should use, and you're looking for that extra rough sandpaper. Well, you could use your eye to look to see what it says on the label, or you could take it to use your eye to feel, and you could put the sandpaper up against your eyeball. Right? Probably it's better to use your eye to see than to use it to feel. So the eye is suited for seeing, and he gives other examples. The heart, you know, pumps blood. This actually is my example. Aristotle gives some different other kinds of examples I think he does talk about the eye scene, but I mean there's other examples. And we know the heart pumps blood. A fin, maybe to help you swim or something like that, or to propel an organism through the water or something. I suppose that to swim is okay there. So fins, you know, can be used for walking, but its real purpose, its intended purpose, is to help an animal swim through the water. You know, what does bacteria do? Well, it decomposes stuff. Right, so you look out at nature, and Aristotle thinks, just like that hammer made by a human being for a purpose, natural things have purposes. Now, I suppose you might say, well, a thing's fulfilling its intended purpose, well, intended by who? And,
lots of move into intelligent design here, it looks like.
I mean, Aristotle's theory really does fit really well with intelligent design. So, Aristotle doesn't necessarily tie... this thing died. Aristotle's theory doesn't necessarily tie intelligent design to these things. He does... I mean, Aristotle does believe in a god, but God's sort of this abstract being that created the world and doesn't have much to do with it. And when he talks about this design, he doesn't invoke the creator. So I think he intends this to exist separately. But if you want to say, well, in order to have things with purposes, you have to have a designer who designed them for a certain purpose.
Does he do that just by ignoring the issue, or
does he
do it by purposeful addressing the issue?
Well, I think he sees that you can have some notion of design apart from a designer by just looking at the thing and what it does. Like, I think he would say you could bring out a pocket watch and see that it's design is to tell time,
without asking questions about where it came from or who created it. Well, I think he thinks you can empirically you can see what its function is. So you can see the function of a watch is to tell time, and you don't need to know where the watch came from to know that that's what its function is. So he's just interested in understanding what human nature is. So he'll say human nature can be determined empirically by just looking at what human beings do. And so if you observe human beings, you can tell what they're for, what they do, and what they do best, what distinguishes them from all the other creatures, and then you can figure out what their purpose is. So we'll see how this like goes, but you can see this how this goes step by step, and then maybe we can come back to this notion of a creator, see whether he needs it or not. So he says, look at plants. So plants have, I think just two things, nutrition and growth. Actually, I'm missing reproduction, aren't I? So plants have nutrition. They suck up minerals and water from the soil. They grow, and I left out reproduction. They reproduce. So those are three functions of plants: nutrition, growth, and reproduction. And then animals, he says, have all those things that the plants have. They have nutrition, they have growth, they have reproduction. And also sensations. You know, a plant. A cabbage doesn't scream when you chop it in two with a meat cleaver, or a cabbage cleaver. I guess I don't know what you call this, vegetable cleaver, a cleaver. I just think about this chef. He has like I'm not a chef, but is there a name for those things? It's just a cleaver, a chopper. So I mean, there's this book called The Secret Life of Plants where supposedly, according to this author, you have this cabbage hooked up to an electroencephalogram that's like reading electrical impulses, and you take a cabbage next to it, and you chop the cabbage in two, and the cabbage is next to it, the encephalogram starts going off the charts like he's afraid or something. And then the guy leaves, and he comes back with the cleaver, and it starts... But that's a bunch of nonsense. But great entertainment. The Secret Life of Plants, if you're ever interested in that. Craziness. But plants don't have perception. Venus flytrap, well, okay, you know, that little, like, sort of reflexes and something lands on it. But plants, according to Aristotle, plants don't have sensation. They just grow and they suck up nutrients and they reproduce. Plants have sensations. They also have locomotion. They can move from place to place. Plants can move a little bit, but they don't move from place to place. They can't be up. They have roots, so they can't move around. Except for, you know, the thing from outer space and Day of the Triffids and the sci-fi things. I'm sure somebody's going to remake those one of these days. Humans. Humans have nutrition, growth, reproduction, which isn't up there, but it's part of the plants. Sensation, locomotion, and what do you think humans have that distinguish them from everybody else?
Mm-hmm.
Actually, Aristotle wouldn't say that. It's part of like, I don't know what that would be. Interestingly, Aristotle doesn't say that. Although, you know, I suppose if you're going to go the evolutionary theory, you might say that's why we have this thing.
That's exactly what I've heard. I'm hearing evolutionary theory.
Yeah, so it's the opposable thumbs led to reason. So he defines
genus, species, all that.
Uh-huh. And Aristotle is really the first biologist. The classifications you get in biology of genus and species and differentiate all come from Aristotle. So he defines human beings as rational animals. So they're animals which can reason. And this makes Aristotle different from Plato. Plato believed, who was Aristotle's teacher, believed that we were an immortal soul imprisoned in a body. Aristotle is more of a naturalistic philosopher, and he doesn't really, he thinks you have a, a soul, but your soul is really sort of the life energy that makes you alive. So I suppose, if you want to, put it one way, Aristotle really doesn't believe in the soul. If you want to put it another way, Aristotle thinks that the soul is kind of a harmony of the body. And so it's a function of the body. So your blood pumps and your biology does a certain thing. Your lungs breathe in air, and it's kind of a function of your body. And Aristotle doesn't know all the details of how these things work, but I think he has a general idea of a kind of a mechanistic sense that there's something called that something your body does, and all its parts work together to make you alive. And that when something goes wrong, you die. But there's no idea that you have an immortal soul that sort of is making you move, that you're a ghost in a machine. He thinks that your soul, your life force, is just a function of your body. Similar to like if you have an automobile, right? You have an automobile, you turn off the key. And if someone asks, well, where did the running of the car go? Where did its energy go? Where's the life of the car? Well, it didn't go anywhere. You just turned it off, right? So, the running of the car is nothing more than the gas, being ignited and the pistons going up and down. So there's no essence of the car separate from the mechanical picture, which makes the car move around and move from place to place. And Aristotle has the same idea about human beings. So man is the rational animal. So what does he do characteristically or uniquely? Rational activity, right? That's the one thing that distinguishes him. Just like the hammer pounds nails, you are intended to think. That is what makes you a human being, is your ability to think. Now, rational activity might mean a lot of things here. Aristotle construes this, I think, kind of narrowly, but you might think of more broadly as sort of being engaged in some sort of activity which requires you to rise above your animal nature. So, playing video games and eating microwave pizzas and all day long without using your mind, I think Aristotle would think would be living like an animal. But something which requires you to use your rational faculties. And I suppose you might say something like being an intellectual or a scholar for Aristotle is the height of what it means to be human. Surprise, surprise. Aristotle's an intellectual and a scholar. If Aristotle were a bricklayer, would he have said the height of virtue is to lay brick upon brick? Your goal in life is to actualize your natural potential, and since your humanity is defined by reason, then your goal is to engage in intellectual activity. So success, a successful life is a life of the mind, or the life of an intellectual. What if you're a woman or a slave boy or something? Well, not everybody can have like a fully actualized life. And Aristotle thinks that you need servants to pour the wine, and you need a woman to keep your house and have your children, and that's just the breaks. Aristotle, again, being a product of his time, is kind of a sexist. A lot of his philosophy is kind of, some of it's very radical for its time, but a lot of it is you could see it kind of fits in with Greek culture, which, was sexist culture. Yeah?
Wouldn't he have been looked down upon by his peers had he not stated things the way he did?
Well, you got his teacher, Plato. Plato was much more of an egalitarian. He had, like, women and men exercising together in the nude in the gymnasium, and women taking part in ruling the state. So, but I think Plato was kind of an oddball in that respect. And that Aristotle is much more traditional and conservative in that way, I suppose. And I mean, if you were living in ancient Greece, you could see, well, you know, you ask the slave boy, unless you're Plato, who's like asking leading questions, you ask the slave boy to do a simple geometry problem, and he can't do it. It's just because he was born a slave. What does he know? And, you know, you women who are educated, you ask somebody's wife, hey, you know, what do you think about this philosophical proposition? And they're probably like, oh, that's just for the men. I don't bother my head about that. Or if they try to answer, they're going to get it wrong because they haven't been educated. So you get this kind of weird thing where you have a sexist institution and where people are expected, people sort of have these expectations that women aren't intellectual and that slaves are inferior, and it just sort of gets, you get, what's the word, confirmation bias. Although, there's, I mean, there are a few exceptions, but by and large, you know, you have a kind of a sexist society where the men get together and philosophize and drink, and the women are at home taking care of the kids and cooking and doing all that womanly stuff. Now, it's interesting to me that Ayn Rand said that Aristotle was the greatest philosopher there ever was. And she was asked, like, who she liked amongst philosophers, and she said she went with the three A's: Aristotle, Aquinas, and Ayn Rand. And so Aristotle was it. And, you know, half of Aquinas is cribbed from Aristotle anyway, so... But she's a woman. Why would she say that? Well, it's because you can take some of these philosophers and see that they might be really wrong at some issue or other and maybe be a product of their times. And you can take their view and say, well, okay, let's just get rid of like this nonsense about whatever, but take the good part and say, this is a pretty good theory if you get rid of this nonsense that was sort of cultural baggage that you can sort of ignore. And you might say that even today, like, the custodian, he collects antique pocket watches, and he knows everything about antique pocket watches. And he's just a guy that, you know, goes around the campus and cleans up stuff, but he can get on the internet. He's got, like, computers and stuff. He watches stuff on the Discovery Channel. And he tell you everything about how to make an antique pocket watch or how do they make plywood, all this stuff. And it's kind of, you know, stuff that I didn't know. And it's kind of intellectual stuff, so you think even one of the great things about living in an affluent, free society is that even a person who's doing simple manual labor can engage in life of mind, too, with mass media and mass culture and libraries and Amazon.com and the Internet and so on. So for Aristotle, though... The ideal life is life of the scholar, the scientist, the intellectual. And this is the life that's going to actualize your potential as a rational animal. So again, what are you? You're a rational animal. What do rational animals do best? Reason. What should you be doing? Using your mind. Reasoning. Doing something which requires you to use your intellect. And, of course, the best way to do that is through being a philosopher, who's the intellectual of intellectuals, according to Aristotle. Oops. And all right-thinking academics. So that's kind of his idea of you know, what you think about what the height of morality is. It's using your mind. It's using your mind in a certain way. Now, how does this work with, you shouldn't steal and shouldn't kill people and so on? It's not obvious right now that we're really talking about morality. We're still just talking about human nature and what your purpose is. It really doesn't tell you what you should do. So that's the part we're going to get to now. So the life which is best is the life of the intellectual, because that's the one which actualizes your potential as a rational animal. Aristotle is a realist. That's what I mean by that. Well, to be an intellectual requires certain trappings. A highly paid, unionized government job, or patronage from the government, or private individual. You need, like, a slave boy to pour the wine. You need friends to philosophize with. You need a certain amount of money. Aristotle tutored Alexander the Great, which was how he made his money for a while. And then the Macedonian regime was toppled, and Aristotle had to get out of Dodge. So maybe it wasn't such a wise choice, but he did tutor Alexander the Great when he was young. So you need, as an intellectual, you have friends. You can't be hideously deformed. So, and this is where case where Aristotle talks about moral luck, and he says, look, if you're born with like two heads, or you got some sort of hideous scar or something like that, or a cleft palate, you talk funny, people aren't going to want to be your friend. And so it's kind of sucks to be you, I think Aristotle would say. That's the way things shake out sometimes. So you need friends, you need wealth, and you need health. And you want to avoid manual labor at all costs. So you go for that tenure track job, by God, or you'll end up washing cars for a living. So you need a certain amount of trappings. This is different from Plato, who thinks you can kind of have a good life by philosophizing off in a cave someplace. Or like Socrates, who kind of lived in poverty all his life. And there was a joke about Socrates that he would always leave to philosophize in the marketplace, and his wife wanted him at home, to take care of the kids since he wasn't working. And the legend was that Socrates would go out and philosophize naked. He'd just leave his robe behind and go out and philosophize anyway in the buff. So Aristotle thinks that the good life is the life of the intellectual, but intellectuals got to eat. And to the extent that you're spending time trying to figure out how you're going to eat, you're not spending time philosophizing. So you need certain things. Oh, also, there's an element of luck in avoiding serious illness or financial ruin. So if you've got money problems, you're going to be worried about those instead of contemplating the eternal verities. And that's going to get in your way. And what's interesting here is this concept of moral luck, that whether you have a good life or not, it's not all up to you. I think Aristotle thinks that if you do the right thing and you become a virtuous person, your chances of having a good life are going to be greatly improved. But it's not a guarantee. So you might have a lousy life anyway. You might, he might say something like, if you start taking drugs and committing petty crimes when you're like a young person, look for ways of trying to take advantage of people, you're probably going to have a bad life. But if you work hard and study and get into a good school, it might be that you're about to graduate and you find out you got cancer or a brain tumor. Or maybe you're waiting for the bus to go to your final exam and you're heading off to Yale Law School and you get hit by the bus because you're not paying attention. Or maybe you get bumped by one of the OWS protesters into the path of the bus accidentally and get plowed over. That's the end of you. The world has one less lawyer to worry about. So, I mean, accidents can happen. So there's no guarantee, but you're going to do much better if you are a virtuous person. So a couple of questions. One is, do natural things really have purposes? And then can you find those purposes just by looking at what they do? And so coming back to like the God thing, intelligent design, it seems like the hammer has a purpose because it was designed by a human being to do a certain thing. But, does it make sense to say like that, in the same sense that bacteria has a purpose too, to decompose things? Well, that's what bacteria does, but to say that it was designed to do that, it seems that its purpose is different than the hammer's purpose. Yeah.
So you're saying function is different than purpose?
It seems like a function seems to involve intention. Purpose seems to involve intention.
Purpose can be different than function.
But to say that something was meant to do act a certain way, it seems like it's saying it was intended. Then you ask the question, well, intended by whom? You know, people say, you ever, people say, like, this is the job I was meant to do, right? Maybe, I'm trying to think of someone, some example, a person, an athlete, might say, I was meant to do this, who's that cyclist guy?
Lance Armstrong.
I was meant to ride, you know, or something like that. But I mean, meant is that either you have, like, God sort of has a plan for your life, or it seems like that meant in kind of like a funny, poetic meaning. It's not, you're not being literal. To say you were meant to do something. Say Annie Leibovitz was meant to take celebrity portraits or something of rock stars. It's kind of a funny use of the word meant. And then the other thing is, if human beings have purposes, do they have to all be the same? Is everyone's purpose to be rational? To be an intellectual? It might be, I mean, some people might be really good at, like, say, nurturing, say. Taking care of kids or small animals. And that's not non-intellectual activity. Other people might be good at fixing things. And maybe there's a little bit of intellectual activity that goes there, but if you deal with sort of like handicrafts or something like that, artistic ability, right? Artistic ability isn't necessarily intellectual, although it can be, but not necessarily. And so, you know, does every human being have the same purpose? And then is what human beings really do best reason? Seems like there are a lot of irrational people out there, and a lot of people are really bad at reasoning, critical thinking. And it might depend on how broadly or narrowly you construe reason, if you're talking about sort of theoretical intellectual reasoning, or if you're talking about maybe more concrete stuff, like problem solving. But even there, it seems, I don't know if I had to pick one thing about what defines humanity, I would say rationality. You look at the world and you think, if that was like really it, we'd have a much different world if everyone was rational. And if being reasonable is what people did best. And I think that's all I got for today. So we're going to talk more about the meat of Aristotle's ideas and the golden mean and all that stuff on Wednesday. And I'll get the topics up right after class here.